Savior, may I learn to love thee, walk the path that thou hast shown. Pause to help and lift another, finding strength beyond my own.
Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at GayMormonStories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Danny Parkinson with your next installation of Gay Mormon Stories. I'm going to continue this week with the Abhow family. I have been talking with Jake and Meg Abhow for the past few months, ever since they appeared at the LDS Family Fellowship group on Facebook. They have a gay son who came out very recently to them, and they started their journey not very long ago trying to understand and be affirming parents for their gay son. And they've done such an amazing job of that that I really want to put them out there as role models on how I wish all parents would respond to their gay children. But meantime, they have a lot of factors going on in this story. They have an amazing son, but they have also some amazing unity. So I really wanted to talk to Jake about his journey. We are going to talk to the other members of his family as part of this series. So you may have already heard Meg or John talk, but if not, that is likely to be included as part of this when it gets released. So welcome, Jake. How are you?
I'm doing just great. How are you, Daniel?
I'm good. So where are you?
Currently, I am in Raleigh, North Carolina, and my family is John and Meg are 2,000 miles away in Utah.
Okay. Well, I guess we're going to get to why that's the case, but let's start out by just going through a little bit about your background and maybe some relevant parts of your history. You come from a really Mormon family, right?
Yes and no. I mean, I do. We were actually the short version here is that when I was about 9 years old, my parents had decided to go back. They wanted to go find some kind of religion in their life. And I think we had been to Baptist Sunday school when we were kids, maybe 4 or 5 times. And my father, who actually worked for Golden Corral, had a colleague at work who was a Mormon. And that kind of intrigued my father, whose name is also John Abhow.
Okay.
And that intrigued him and about their lifestyle and what great people they were. And so we'd actually decided my parents had decided to go attend the Mormon church that coming week just to go check it out. Didn't tell anybody, just said, we're going to go check it out this week. Well, the Friday before, when my mom was at home by herself, knock, knock, the missionaries knocked on her door and basically they tracked it into her.
This was just randomly before the week they were planning to go anyway.
Completely random. So, I mean, I guess you make the argument that the missionaries were fasting and praying heavily that week. But, they knocked on the door. And the funny thing is my mother actually said I don't know what she was doing, but she was thinking something was on the stove because she was really, really busy at the time when she opened the door. And they gave their little pitch, you know, Planet Happiness pitch or whatever it was. And my mother, who was a very engaging person, socially engaging, she was really short with them. She goes, oh, my gosh, I'm so glad you're here. I can't talk to you now. We're planning on coming to church on Sunday. We'll see you there. And the elders, you know, exercising every bit of faith that they had, they said, okay, we'll see you out there. We'll be waiting in the lobby for you. To greet you. And then that was it. That was the whole conversation there at the door. And I'm sure, I mean, I served a mission, so I'm sure as they were walking to the next door, they probably looked at each other and said, well, that was different. That was that was a new one. It's the easiest way to get rid of a couple of elders, right? Just tell them you're going to come to church. So anyway, the next morning was a Saturday morning, and my father was home, and they were talking about going to church. And my mother told her, told my dad, the elders came, knocked on the door. I think she just called them the guys. The Mormon guys came and knocked on the door, and they were trying to figure out. They looked at the address where to go, but didn't know what time church started. And so, good old Yellow Pages. They called the phone number that was listed in the Yellow Pages, which was probably the clerk's office. And so they called the church, got the old Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And then my mom said, "Hey, some of your guys came by yesterday. They invited us to church. We want to come, but what time do you meet?" And the response was, they were pro the response is they said, "Well, what were their names?" Probably trying to figure out what ward to send us to. And so she said, "What were their names?" And she said, she's like, "One of them was standing behind the other one, so I couldn't see his little name tag, but I looked really carefully at one of them, and I know his first, I don't remember his last name, but his first name was Elder." And that was it. And I swear,
That's
Daniel,
helpful.
the clerk on the other end kept his cool, kept his composure, and he just said, okay, that's helpful." And somehow they worked it out, and they got a time. They said 11 o'clock or whatever it was. But never let on at all that they were both elders or any of that. And so, here we go. My mom, my dad, and my brother and I, there's just four of us in our family. We get dressed for church, go into the lobby, and sure enough, those two missionaries were waiting in the lobby, with big grins on their face, invited us in, taught us the discussion in 3 weeks, and we were baptized like 4 weeks later.
Wow.
I mean, truly, truly the cliche golden family, right? And so that, I mean, that was us, and then so from 9 years old on, I was raised in the church. So I don't know the primary songs as well as a lot of other kids do, but I don't have a lot of memories outside of the church, more flashes and whatnot. So raised in the church, but also remember times not being in the church, as a young kid. So, I mean, I remember a beer or two in the refrigerator, like as a 6-year-old. I remember trying beer, like when I was a kid, like at the dinner table, stuff like that. But for the most part, yeah, really prominent. My father was he was a member of the 70 when they had them at a local level. Yeah, my mother was a young women's president, all that kind of stuff. We went to the temple a year after we got baptized, and to get sealed and everything. Just we did everything
So for
just
you
by the book.
personally, was this like an exciting event?
I
Did
don't
you?
really remember it. I mean, for me, it was just, oh, here's another group of people that I get to meet and hang out with, like Sunday school. I mean, you're 9. Not to take anything away from any 9-year-olds, because I'm sure 9-year-olds think they're pretty old and mature. But I don't really remember it as much of anything. Your parents say jump, you jump at that age for the most
Was your
part.
brother older than you?
Yeah, but yes, but very close in age. He's 14 months older. So we're very close in age. And then just 4 years later, my father got leukemia and passed away. And so from 13 years on, the age that John is, my son is now, I didn't have my dad in the church. And so then my mom raised us that way, went on missions and everything.
So it
So
became a small family. I mean, it was small by Mormon standards already, but your
Right.
dad really got involved in the church in a big way, became a 70, but his life in the church was pretty short. It
Yes, it was.
was also short
But
as far from
to
your
give.
perspective and your family too. That's an early age to lose your father.
Right. And people ask me about that, and you're like, "Well, wow, how did you handle that?" And my response is always, "Well, I mean, I don't know anything different. I don't know what it's like to have had a father at 15, 16. So for me, it's just that those are the cards I was dealt. You know, I mean, you just deal with it. But this will sum up my father. One, very sarcastic, very lovable, tons and tons of friends. But one year after joining the church, after going through the temple for the very first time, my mom told me this later, is they went through their own endowment and they went into the celestial room. And my mother was saying, as they went through the veil and went into the celestial room, she was saying, let's get the H out of here. You know, it freaked her out.
Oh, okay.
The temple session. She said, what on earth did we get into, you know? And she was beelining it to my father to tell him, you know, this is nuts, right? And yeah. So as they both kind of walk through around the same time, she is just like straight lined it over there to him. And before she could get a word out of her mouth, my dad said these words. He says, it makes so much sense now, doesn't it? And so she just, you know, shoulder slumped and all the wind out of her sails was taken away. So she was like, well, okay, maybe what am I missing? You know?
Yeah.
And then like anything that people go to the temple, I mean, any kind of repetition, you know, you start to become more accustomed to it. It becomes more normal. But that was my dad, you know, and his.
Well, it's interesting because that's a people really run the spectrum in how they respond to the temple the first time. And, you know, I was more like your mom, but people talk about being like your dad. It just really resonating with us. So it's interesting that they kind of were at both ends of the extreme there.
Yes, it was. I didn't know that until maybe about 5 years ago. My mother told me that story.
Yeah.
But you know, for how the church goes, I guess my dad, he rose pretty quickly in the ranks, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, and we were members 3 years, only 3 years when he got sick, because he was sick for about a year, and I don't remember him as anything but, like I said, I think he might have been the ward mission leader, and then area like the area 70, and then he got sick, and that was it.
Yeah.
So.
And so, but at this point, I'm guessing that your family, you know, framed this in a Mormon way, that it was, I'm assuming it was kind of a comfort that he had so fully embraced the gospel before he died. I mean,
We were Mormon through and through, rock solid in the faith. I mean, our life, for being members 3 years once he got sick, I mean, no, you would have never known that we weren't lifers.
Yeah.
I mean, we were just, I mean, it's pretty amazing for me to see people that join the church now and watch, just watch the change and kind of how long it takes.
Yeah.
Before you really become quote unquote Mormon, you know, culturally and spiritually, if you will. But, and looking back on our family, it's amazing kind of how we just got sucked into it and did it, and we owned it, and that was it.
Yeah.
Now, as a 9 and 10 year old, my brother and I, again, your parents say jump, you jump. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of pushback from us or any reason for us to think any different. You know, so we just, you know, I had a couple of really good friends at church and a kind of a cute blonde girl that was my age, and I was hooked.
Yeah.
So.
Two blondes.
That's all, you know.
Is that a pattern in your life? Okay.
Yeah, I think it is.
So then tell me about your, you know, as a youth, you know, after that, I mean, a lot of young men go through a rebellious stage. I mean, this must have impacted your chance of having a rebellious stage, you know, dealing with your father's dying that time of year, and then the extra responsibility that brings to a family to try to stick together. You know, after losing a parent, what was this like? How did this impact your formation as a Mormon youth?
Well, it was interesting because up until that point, in school. I was in eighth grade. In fact, we found out like 2 weeks before eighth grade was finished that well, it was 2 weeks before eighth grade was done that we pretty much knew that he was going to die. So all of eighth grade, he was sick. And then 2 weeks before the school was out, we found out that he was pretty much going to probably die. And he had been down. My mom and dad had been in Florida. He received a bone marrow transplant, which was successful, but they mostly they usually are. But it's the recovery from the actual transplant that a lot of patients don't survive. So, I mean, technically, he died of pneumonia while his immune system was shot. And so we had a pretty good idea that that was going to happen. I got pulled out of class by the guidance counselor, and she sat me down and she said, "You're going to Florida in an hour. Your cousin, who was actually staying with us at the time, taking care of us, is going to be here in 10 minutes to pick you up. He has you packed." And we went, well, I went right from school right to a plane, and my brother and I flew down to Florida. And it was the first time I'd ever been on a plane, actually. And we got off the plane, and my mother said, first thing out of her mouth was, "He's not going to make it, And to this day, she regrets that being the first thing, because she said she sat there for 2 hours waiting for us, wondering what she was going to say, and it was everything but that. And so she said that, and she burst into tears because she was like, "That's not how I wanted to start this." And so we were there for about a week before we knew he was going to die, and they flew him home to Raleigh on a Learjet, and he lived for about 3 or 4 days, and so he died at home, which is what we all kind of wanted to do. He could have stayed around for maybe a month or a month and a half in Florida, in the hospital, but we elected to have him come home, and just have a couple of days of normalcy at home. So, but the following year, well, I should say the following summer, right, the immediately summer afterward, my faith in the plan of salvation, all the Velcro, little sticker things that you put when you're teaching the lesson about, premortal existent, birth, death, judgment, all that, celestial kingdom, whatever, was pretty rock solid. I mean, I felt like I had a really firm grasp on what was going to happen in the next life, and believed it like I believed it like I knew I had two eyes. It was just sure. It was like there was no question about it to me. And so when my dad died, I literally was like, okay, now he's in spirit paradise, and that's the next step. And it was like, not to say it wasn't a big deal, but I didn't internalize it like it was a big deal. I mourned at the loss of somebody that I loved, but it didn't tear me apart. And that really it really concerned my mom. She was concerned. My mother was very, very concerned that I was not appropriately handling or mourning the loss of a father. Like, I wasn't crying enough. I wasn't moping enough. I wasn't lurking around the house just self-loathing and the why me kind of thing. But for me, I still to this day I attribute that to a very strong testimony of how I felt the afterlife was going to be set up. I just felt like this is the next step of life is death, and then there's this, and then there's this. And it was just like it didn't faze me as much as it should have. And so she sent me to go see a psychiatrist because she thought I was just burying these deep emotions and not coming to terms with it. And we met for an hour, like a first session, and he told her, "This guy is just, he's good. There's like nothing going on. He's handling everything the way he's supposed to." And so I saw him one more time, and about 5 minutes into the session, we started just talking about stuff that didn't relate because he was just, I think I was so expressive on my feelings and thoughts and how it pertained to my faith that he didn't really see a need to have me keep coming back. And so that was my summer, and I never really had any kind of rebound or like 6 months later, just everything fell apart. I literally to this day, Daniel, and I don't care what religion or faith you are, I believe that God just said, you know what, I'm going to make this easy on you. And he did. And it wasn't like I didn't love my father. It wasn't like I wasn't sad all the time. I mean, I was. I definitely was like, oh, why is this happening to me? This is not fair. You know, everybody else has their dad. I definitely had those thoughts, but it wasn't just, I did not wear it on my sleeve. Yeah. Like a normal person. I don't know. So, but I will say the following year, I'm sorry, the previous year while he was sick, I got like 5 C's, grades in school. And I'd never gotten anything but an A up until that year, you know, straight A's my entire life. And I got like 5 C's, and I think my A was in PE, 'cause I wasn't gonna, that's a hard one to fail.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, I was distracted, sure. And I'm sure it affected me that way, but, I wasn't crazy rebellious. I don't think, I was a little mischievous, but not harmful. I mean, it was more like just harmless fun, as opposed to, I wouldn't go and egg houses, you know, but, I would, I might just drive recklessly, you know, I don't know. A little worse than the next guy.
Yeah.
But I wasn't, you know, I didn't get into alcohol or drugs or anything like that, you know, and I maintained, I was the good Mormon. You know, I was the president of the deacons. I was the president of the teachers, the president of the priests, got my mission call, did, you know, the whole nine yards. Okay. And never really.
And so you were at that point having a typical Mormon experience where you were a big part of your social life was the youth groups and the.
Absolutely. And I was it. I was your Mormon. I was your poster board Mormon, you know.
And was it hard times economically for your family because your father wasn't around, or were things?
A little bit. We never, I don't feel like we ever felt it as kids. Like I never thought I was poor. You know, we had life insurance money. I know that was kind of carrying us through, or my mom. And my mom actually went back to school and she became a nurse.
Uh-huh.
After my father died. And so she was bringing in a decent enough income.
Okay.
You know, but we certainly didn't have a lot of money, but we were not wanting.
Okay.
At all.
And so for you, you can't think of anything that particularly sets apart your adolescence or childhood that's relevant to, you know, how you came to later on to some of the issues you're facing lately, or
not at all. There was no kind of no real deep secrets or yeah, I mean, like I said, I mean, it was almost, I mean, yeah, I was your just typical Mormon kid. I mean, I'm sure I went through stuff just like anybody else did, but I wasn't living like a double life or like was secretly just wanting, I wasn't suicidal. I mean, you know, I didn't have any kind of really dark moments. In my life, I've never faced depression, and that to me was never a real thing. And until I've met people and people that are close to me that have faced, you know, depression and thoughts of suicide and things that, I can't say I've ever really truly considered what that would be like. Yeah. Until I was kind of forced to, and it became real. I was like, wow, that's a real thing. I just thought it was, I don't know what I thought it was, you know, but to me that wasn't real. I was probably very, judgmental on something like that and saying, ah, just get over yourself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Get up and go take a run and go do something fun and get over it. I mean, that's probably how I would have treated it, because I just never dealt with that. I was a pretty happy kid. I mean, my brother and I played competitive tennis, you know, all throughout our childhood and juniors, and we competed in tournaments over the weekends. And we had that. We had church, and we had like a social, like a tennis social life that was like a physical outlet. We were both good students, A's and B's students, and yeah, I mean, lots of friends. I mean, popular, whatever that means, fairly popular in school, and I had girlfriends, and the works.
And was there ever some kinds of dissonance about your religious experience, or a really common thing for adolescents is to have shame, or there's sort of some ubiquitous Mormon experiences of young men, certainly about guilt, about porn or masturbation or things that are kind of universal yet very not dealt with in our culture.
I mean, it would seem so, but I tell you, the first time that I ever kissed a girl, I was 15, almost 16, which even I mean, I know you're not supposed to date until you're 16 as Mormons. That wasn't really that pushed. That wasn't pushed that much in my generation, and not as much as it is now. So I was pretty innocent as far as that. As far as that all came, sexually and everything. I mean, I feel like I probably got a fairly late start to that. And I had such, I had so many other social and physical outlets that didn't really, it wasn't something that like reared its ugly head for me. Because, like I said, I was very, very busy. And I don't know if I may have subconsciously just kept myself really, really busy to, I don't know. I mean, I hear about people now, and I look at kids now and the stuff that people deal with, and I'm serious, Daniel. I just feel like I didn't really have to deal with a whole lot. And now I say that, and somebody else would say, well, you lost your dad. That's dealing with something, and to this day, I still feel I'm like, you know what? I think that might just be a trade-off that I was given, or whatnot. I lost my dad, but I had three or four men in my ward who, I mean, they stepped up and played a significant role in a positive way in my life as like father figures. I always had somebody who took me to the fathers and sons campouts and kind of took me under their wing. Would go take me to play golf for the first time and just do all that kind of stuff. And it's not fair. I don't think this is fair, but I think what it was is people had seen our family get baptized, come to church, become really, really active, really, really strong, prominent members in their religion very quickly, and then a death, and then we're left with like this, you're left with a widow and two kids, two pretty likable kids. I mean, my brother was the president in his quorums, as he kind of went out. So you've got these, I wouldn't say we were Peter Priesthood type people. I don't think anybody ever looked at us like that kind of like the perfect Mormon thing, because I mean we were punks in our own way, immature boys. I'm sure we treated people disrespectfully as much as the next 15-year-old kid, but we were definitely very visible at church, and just our life was very visible, I think, just because people from afar were probably always looking at, oh, how's the widow doing? How the fatherless kids doing? Who are actually kind of well known and seem well adjusted. I don't know. And I think a lot of some of the men in my life, who I deem as father figures, it was probably easy to become a father figure for us because we weren't like troubled teens, and so I felt like I just kind of had this nice segue into adulthood or into a mission. Now, that did change a little bit. I went to Appalachian State. I went to school there for
For
a
one
year
year before your mission.
Before my mission. And I don't know if you want to get to that or not yet, or if you have any other questions, but I really honestly, I don't think I ever asked myself if I wanted to serve a mission. I don't feel like it was ever an option that I didn't serve a mission. because it was something that I was just always going to do.
Yeah.
And I never sat and said, do you want to serve a mission? I never considered it.
The question was already answered.
Yeah. And it was, and that may have had to do with my dad, an expectation that I know my father had of me. And that my brother had gone before me. So there was that expectation. There's an expectation in the ward that, you know, all these guys that you go on missions, you know. And so I definitely will say I did not go on a mission because I wanted to go on a mission. I went on a mission because that's what you do when you turn 19.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, and it, that didn't bother me. I didn't think, oh, I shouldn't go on a mission, or I should, or I'm going for the wrong reasons. I mean, that never crossed my mind. It was just, here's the next step in life. And my life has been set out before me. Like I said, when my dad died, my core, the thing that got me through his death was, I think, my belief in the plan of salvation. It was a step-by-step process to success, spiritual success. You know, it was a very clear path, and the mission was part of it. You come home, you get married, you know, all these steps are just, you check them off along your way towards exaltation. I mean, I think
that worked for you both in your vision of, you know, of life's purpose, but also in a functional way in your life.
Right. And it felt logical. It was something that I could wrap my brain around. It made sense. And, I was thinking I can do this, you know, this isn't that big of a deal. But there was certainly as much of a social element to it, of these are my people, all these Mormon people, we're all going on missions. This is what you do. So there was a pressure to go, a social pressure to go, even though I never felt like I was pressured. It was, like I said, I don't know how else to say it other than it was just the next step, in life. But prior to that, I graduated in 91, went to school, went off to Appalachian State for a year, met a girl there, cute blonde, and that I just fell, I mean, head over heels for, like never before. And we went from 0 to 60 in 2 days, in like the depth of our relationship. And I can't explain it. You know, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is what love is. This is what it's about. There's no way I won't marry her. She was one of six Mormons at Appalachian State that I knew of.
Uh-huh.
And we dated, and, this is a story for another time because I don't know who will hear this, but for her sake, I'll just say this, that we dated for basically the whole year that I was at Appalachian State. And during that year, I found this out much, much later, that she, had been dating somebody else, is deeply, deeply emotionally involved with somebody else that she was with me, the entire time. He lived in a different city. He never came to visit her at school. Our paths would never, ever cross. When I kind of found out, I mean, it scarred me. I mean, it was a difficult thing for me. The odd thing of it now, this person I am actually in business with right now, the other guy, on a couple uh-huh. side projects, and we are unbelievably, amazingly good friends. But that is a whole nother story for another day, another book, another soap opera.
I've seen a few of those soap operas in my life too.
Right.
So it's funny how the different connections people make.
Let me address another thing of that will relate.
But did she marry him, or did she
nope.
not end up?
No,
she
no.
didn't marry either one of you. So she was having a hard time deciding.
She sent us both on missions. And I will get to this later, but I was called to go to the Ivory Coast, West Africa. I got sick over there, came home, and then finished in Montreal.
Oh, okay.
We'll get to that, but
Montreal, the greatest mission on earth, Canada, Montreal.
There you go.
There you go.
Yep, that's where you are.
Okay, how lucky you got sick so you could go to Montreal.
There you go. But she, we were, he and I were both went on missions. He actually came home from his mission, just couldn't hack it. And while we were both in the MTC, which we didn't overlap, but it was close, she got engaged to somebody else while she was still writing us letters talking about our future babies and living in the eternities with us. I mean,
Okay.
he and I spent a weekend together with all of our letters and all that stuff, and there were some letters that were word for word the same. Literally talking about our children and eternal marriage and celestial kingdom, this kind of stuff. Like the same letter that we both would receive on the same day that she sent to the NPC. I mean, crazy stuff, Daniel, crazy
Yeah,
stuff.
well.
And meanwhile, she's dating somebody, engaged to somebody else. So, anyway,
Well, I hope
like
it
I
went well
said,
for her. I
another
hope,
time,
yeah.
but that year at Appalachian State, there were some signs of that here and there, but at Appalachian State, I turned to alcohol a little bit, not excessively, but I had roommates that smoked pot. They drank alcohol. I mean, I was the only guy that was at the school that actually went to church on Sunday. So I was the only male active member of the church at that school while I was there.
Okay.
Which it's a I think there was 13,000 students. I'm sure there were plenty there who weren't going, but there was a small branch. There were six girls that went, and there was me, and then there was a local kid who was about my age, but he was not a student
Yeah.
at Appalachian State. So I didn't have any male Mormon friends at ASU.
Yeah.
And so all my friends were non-Mormons. None of them knew my history of being Mormon, not drinking, any of that. They didn't really know anything about Mormons. So these were now my friends. And call it whatever you want, succumb to temptation, your freshman year in college and whatever,
Yeah.
I had fun at college.
Pretty common.
Yeah. But in the meantime, I put papers in for my mission, kind of doing a little, kind of being a little bit of a bad boy, but starting to kind of straighten up. I did a third semester at Appalachian State because of when my birthday fell. It's at the end of September, so I didn't turn 19 until I would have already been in my sophomore year. So I decided to go ahead and finish that semester and go on my mission at Christmas time,
Okay.
Esther. So I
And
got
you were
a, I
away from
got
home. I mean, this wasn't right in your town. This was away from home.
three and a half hour drive from home,
Okay. So
close
you were
enough
kind of
to
having a
come.
rumspringa. Do you know what that is?
No.
I mean, not a serious one, but the Amish, they send their youth out and live in the world for a while. But I
Yeah.
think a lot of Mormons, even in Utah, kind of have this thing, at least in my generation, we all kind of went through this where we kind of
You
felt,
test the waters,
yeah, we
you.
kind of felt a permission. It was never approved by our parents, but it was so widespread among the culture, the youth culture, that the guys were going to be drinking on Saturday and blessing the sacrament on Sunday. We were
Yeah.
going to be confessing our sins to the bishop. I mean, there was a lot of sort of stuff that people sort of were sowing their wild oats with, kind of knowing that they were gonna, clean it all up in time to go on their mission. I mean,
Yeah,
I think that's fairly common, or was
you
it in my
worded it per
generation?
you worded it perfectly, and it's exactly what you're taught not to do. You don't sin knowing you're going to repent later. You just don't sin. But you do it. But I mean, it's if you understand the gospel, you actually understand how it works, and you know that, well, I can always repent later because there's no rule against that.
Yeah.
And in my mind, I never all of this never once did I consider not going on a mission. I never thought I wasn't going to go.
Yeah.
So I never thought I wasn't going to stop what I was doing. Just like you said, I was like, when I decide to stop, I'll stop. And that's exactly what I did. I literally, and I don't remember the details around it because it was a long time ago, but I literally remember saying, okay, it's time to stop. And I stopped.
Yeah.
Done. And there wasn't a phasing out period. I just stopped. because I was like, okay, I need to respect my religion and my God and the leaders of the church around me that I'm, you know, and I got my mission call and I was a good boy for a couple months and I went on my mission.
Wow. So to Ivory Coast.
To the Ivory Coast.
Wow. So I guess you went to the MTC to learn French.
I did. I went to the MTC, great experience. I loved every minute of it. I mean, really enjoyed the MTC. I went over Christmas, which was really exciting because while we were there, during the 9 weeks that I was there, with the exception of President Benson, every member of the First Presidency and Apostles spoke during that time at the MTC, which doesn't happen.
Yeah.
But most of them, because they're home for Christmas and they all came. And I had heard before that Christmas in the MTC was the way to do it. And I actually tried to plan on doing that. And I got lucky and it worked out. And it was a great, it was an amazing experience. I loved it. And I went to the Ivory Coast and the Ivory Coast is pretty hazy to me as far as how I remember it. But I mean, I was there and I don't know if I drank the water or what it was, but I started getting just really bad stomach flu and really bad dizzy spells and then starting to feel like I wasn't supposed to be there. Like almost like spiritually, you know, like I'm not in the right spot. Something's wrong. I'm sick. I in my head, I was like, I need to go home. Something's not right.
Yeah.
I remember going in, they took me to hospital there and we're going in there. Well, I need to back up, Daniel, and tell you that this mission, I happen to know that Richard G. Scott, Elder Scott of the 12, went through, he had a stack of like 100 missionary papers. All of them had reference to having some exposure to French, high school French or something. And he flipped through the pages in less than 2 minutes, pulled 5 papers out and put them on a table and said, these are our Ivory Coast elders. And I was one of them. And we were the first 5, from the United States to go.
Oh, okay.
So I won't go into the details of how I know that, but I do know that from firsthand of somebody that was in the room, with him, and they pulled my companion aside to tell us because they thought we'd want to know, and it was cool. It was just kind of cool to hear that.
So you guys felt like you were opening up. I mean, they had missionaries there that were native.
Yes, the native local missionaries, one from England and one from Haiti.
Uh huh.
Everybody else was local. My companion, when I got out there, my companion was 32 years old, had never been to the temple, and his mother lived up the street.
Oh, really? Okay.
You know, and didn't speak a lick of anything but French.
Yeah.
And, you know, like day one, he's asking me about the temple in French. And I'm like, man, I can't tell you about the temple in English, much less French, you know, but so we're trying to communicate. And here I am, I'm having a hard time physically. And there's some level of spiritually, something's attached to it. And I never really could figure it out. But the what I was going to tell you in the hospital, Daniel, is we go to the hospital and all over on the walls. I mean, first of all, there's people have like cardboard boxes, like all laid out and people are like laying down the hallways, just laying there. I don't know if they're dead or dying or just waiting to be seen, but you know, there's just people everywhere just laying around.
Yeah.
In the country itself, the rumor, I don't know if it's a wives' tale or not, but what I heard out there is that you can eat bananas and survive all day on eating just bananas. Like you get enough nutrients from bananas as long as you're drinking water to survive. And people would sit underneath basically like banana trees or banana bushes or whatever, and in the shade all day long. And it's literally, you were just like looking people who were just surviving.
Yeah.
and I felt like it was like that in the hospital. And this may be a gross thing, but I'll say it anyway, because it was one of the most memorable things. We're walking through and they wanted to give, they handed me like this little Petri dish, almost this little plastic dish. And they said, we need a stool sample. And I was like, what am I, how do you do that? So I mustered through doing that. And then I came back, and as I'm coming back, there are these signs all over the hallways, every door that you go into, these little posters that were 8.5 by 11, like sheets of paper. And they had 10 faces on them. All of them were like Africans, all black faces, men, women, kids, you know, old people, everything. Six of them had big, huge red X's on them. And I was like, what is that? And then in French, and I'll translate it for you, but in French, 6 out of 10 people have SIDA. Tomorrow it could be you. And wow. SIDA, you can rearrange the letters and you get AIDS really quickly. And like that was the poster that was everywhere. It was warning you against AIDS. And so we go in, I give them my stool sample, and I'm with not with the mission president, but with one of the couple missionaries, with one of the brethren. And he was with me, and they go to take blood, and they go and they use a needle. They go and they use a needle that has been used before, and they put it in a sterilized dish, and they go to reuse it. And he stepped out in front. He said, no, no. And he went to his bag and gave them a needle, a clean needle, wow, where they took blood. Yeah, you talk about some scary stuff. But the long story short is, after no real signs of anything changing, they decided to send me home. I think it was a better safe than sorry situation because we were some of the first to go. Yeah. And Elder Earl C. Tingey of the 70 happened to be coming through the mission home. I was in the mission home for about a week and a half before I went home. And Elder Earl C. Tingey of the 70, he came through to the mission home, and I had a chance to just sit and talk to him for like an hour and a half privately. And I don't remember the conversation, but I remember it being very positive, uplifting, and feeling really good about myself at the end of it. And I saw him years later at a BYU devotional, and I waited in line to talk to him, and you know, and he remembered me, and I told him I went and finished at Montreal and whatnot. But I was home for 6 months.
But just like, how long did you end up staying in Ivory Coast?
I was in Ivory Coast for about 2.5 months.
Uh-huh. And was this so all five of you were just sort of spread out?
Yes.
So you were just sort of in this experience where you're in this new country, and you not only were isolated from, you know, just by being in this country that was this world's different than anything you've ever seen before, but you didn't even have other sort of American elders. The only people you had was this couple missionary in your world that had kind of otherwise seemed familiar, right?
Correct. I actually never saw, for the 2.5 months I was there, I never saw, other than the initial transfer day, I never saw another missionary, even when I left. I take that back. I did see a couple of the guys from the MTC here or there, but it was, I mean, I don't remember it. I mean, it was 3 or 4 times maybe, you know, and they were really brief in passing.
Yeah.
We did not get together as districts or anything like that, but I definitely remember proselyting and going around with my companion and going to church. And I remember the mission, but I don't remember participating a whole lot. I mean, the language was still really new. But the thing I do remember that's kind of fun is kids used to always come up to me because most of these kids had never seen a white person before.
Yeah.
And they had a slang term there, and it was tubabu, and it meant white person. Uh-huh. And so I would walk down and people would say tubabu, tubabu. And, you know, and I quickly learned what that was, and they would come up to me and they would rub on my skin. They thought I was dirty. They were trying to rub all the white stuff off to get to the brown.
Yeah.
And they rubbed their hands through my hair. Cause I've kind of dirty blonde hair now, but I had pretty blonde hair back then, and, they'd want to touch my hair and everything. And Daniel, I cannot believe I almost forgot the most significant thing about my experience there and how it relates to my current situation. And this to this, I mean, to this day, up until the last 3 months, this is something that was hard for me to even tell people because it was uncomfortable. But there was a tradition there, or culture there, that men who are very, very good friends, like very close friends, will hold hands. Or when they walk, or they'll touch each other when they walk. Like, well, he'll have his one person will have his finger on the other one's arm, or they'll just have some kind of connection, physical touching connection. And it's a sign of very, very close admiration and respect, completely platonic, but that's in their culture. And we were told that when we arrived there, hey, this is kind of the deal. If you see this, it doesn't mean that people are homosexual. It means that they're close and they have mutual respect. It did not happen among the women. It was only the men. And I remember thinking, oh crap. I was like, I don't want to do that. Because I was just not comfortable with that, but I had enough respect. I mean, the 15-year-old in me would probably jokingly hold hands with the other MTC buddy of mine, you know what I mean? And being probably disrespectful, you know what I mean? I mean, but I had enough respect there to think, okay, that's a little bit much for me. That's a little awkward. I don't really ever want to do that. I can see it, that's fine, but I don't really ever want to do it. And I remember having those thoughts. And so I'm out there for, I was proselyting for a month and a half before I started to get kind of sick. And so I was with my companion for a month, month and a half, and we had a dinner appointment every night somewhere. We ate rat, we had like a roasted rat and all other kinds of interesting things. But the best pineapples in the world, but I'll leave that as that. But so about a month to a month and a half in, like as I was starting to complain of nausea and starting that was kind of beginning to set in, my companion and I were walking somewhere and he reached over and grabbed my like a couple of my fingers, and I remember, I mean, we're walking and without stopping walking, I remember kind of being frozen, but I was just kind of still just walking and processing what was going on and saying, okay, this guy, I need to think, wow, I should be honored. I should be flattered, at that. And you see, he kind of was holding like my pinky and my ring finger and my left hand, just kind of grabbing the two. And he had like a light grasp or light hold on him. And we took 10, 20 more steps. And I didn't know what you're supposed to do. I didn't read the cliff notes on how to handle that situation. I just knew that it happened. And so I kind of manned up, if you will, and I grabbed his hand, and we walked to our next appointment hand in hand, and I just kind of owned it, and remember thinking, this might be the most uncomfortable I've been in my life, but I'm gonna own it. And I did, and that was the only time that we did it. It was just the one time. I don't know. It was a spiritual positive experience
Wait, just a sec.
with this other human.
Can you say that again? It was a spiritual.
This it was a spiritual experience for me because I was bonding with another human in a way that I felt was taboo or uncomfortable and awkward, a way that was not accepted. But it felt right. Because I was in the culture, it was having it feel right did not make it any less awkward or uncomfortable, but it didn't feel bad, And to this day, Daniel, I haven't walked around. I've never held another man's hand, I just don't have a reason to. But I remember having that experience and remembering how grueling, painful, and uncomfortable it was, but feeling like it was the right thing to do at the time, and just holding my head high and owning it, because I knew if I pulled away, that would be the most, that was, I probably could not have insulted my companion anymore, than if I had pulled away. So, so I knew that I had enough sense, or compassion or whatnot to not do that, which is what I wanted to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what an experience. 'Cause at 19, there aren't that many 19-year-old, you know, boys from the US who are confronted with that scenario and trying to overcome sort of the prejudice, but it's also really built into you. I mean, I just kind of a fleeting touch in our culture, in American culture, is we kind of really do go out of our way to avoid touching each other, you know, especially casually. There's, you know, I deal with Latinos and they're much more comfortable touching each other and invading right. their space. But as Americans, we just aren't. And that to me became relevant when I had a girlfriend, for example, and I just wasn't inclined to touch her, you know, just in a normal way. There was sort of I had this sort of electric field that I didn't like penetrating, you know? And so I can see that you would feel the same way in that scenario. That would be to you, and to him, it was nothing, or just a small gesture of normal friendship. And to you, it was really intense because he was entering your electric field and in a way that no one had ever done, even though it was just holding hands. But so, I could see why that'd have a strong meaning.
Right. And I forget about that often, actually. But even going into this, and I knew we were going to talk about our mission, when you first asked me if there was anything from my childhood or from my early years that might directly relate to the situation that we're in now, I literally was thinking in my mind, I was like, I don't think there's anything. I don't think I had gay friends or any of that. It occurred to me that I held hands with another man on my mission until just now when you start to kind of probe about it. I just find that's kind of interesting, of how significant that really was probably in how I frame this situation when I talk about it.
Well, you certainly had to expand your mindset in that moment.
Right.
And so I can't imagine it not playing a role when you're having to do that in a different, you know, in a much bigger way. But so you ended up going home because you were sick and you had to recover for 6 months before you went back in the field?
Sort of. I came home and I was, I got healthy pretty quickly. I was released and I got healthy pretty quick. And so there was a little bit of a mystery around it, and it wasn't, nobody really dug deeply into what was going on, but we were just everybody, my state president, myself, my parent, my mom, we were all focused on just getting me back out. And I wanted to go back out as soon as I could. But they don't typically send you to, if you went overseas and came home, they don't typically send you overseas again. They typically, you go home and you go serve in Oklahoma, you know, and I apologize for anybody that served in Oklahoma, but I'm sure Oklahoma is wonderful. But you usually serve stateside, and they'd asked me, my state president said, well, I know there's a French mission in Montreal. Would you be open to doing that if that's what the brethren decide to do? And I said, absolutely. And that was a conversation early on. But it was 6 months before, I don't know, paperwork or whatnot. I got a job, you know, and, kind of got back into social life a little bit, but not really, because I did not want to get involved socially with the people around me in church, because I knew that I was about to go back out on my mission.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to start having relationships, you know, male or female, knowing that they would be cut off any day. But I did a little bit, you know, I wasn't going to sit around and do nothing, but I did get a job. I thought getting a job would be a good idea. It would keep me busy. I waited, and actually I got a job with a friend of mine who is currently the Stake Young Men's president in my stake here in Raleigh. He and I were together when I got the phone call from my stake president, and he said, hey, I've got a call for you. You're going to Montreal and you leave on Monday or Tuesday. And this was Friday.
Okay.
And And I was excited. And he also said, and you are going back to the NTC for 3 weeks, and you're going to go to your mission with a different district, which I had requested because I didn't want to go straight from being home 6 months to right mission field. It would have been, I don't know, it would have been too much, I think. And they had asked me that earlier on, and I did say if I have a choice, I'd love to go back to the MDC for just a couple of weeks, like a little refresher, French refresher, all of it, which was kind of fun, Daniel, because I went back to the MDC, got thrown into a district, went out to Montreal, and there were five people in Montreal at that time that were in my district the first time around in the MPC when I went to the Ivory Coast. So I went to Montreal already knowing five elders really well. But none of them knew I was coming. I just showed up and went like, "Hey, what are you doing here?" So that was kind of fun. But then I served, finished my mission there.
So how much did you do in Montreal? How long were you in Montreal?
Well, it was interesting. I never did the math. I didn't do the math until actually I came home. I actually collectively, if you combine all my mission time, MTC time, I actually served for 22 and a half months. But it was an interesting thing. I came home the Christmas before I came home. Keep in mind my third consecutive Christmas away from home, because of my. Because of the timing of when I
Yeah,
left
the
and came
interrupted
home.
part, yeah.
Yeah, so I had three consecutive Christmases as a missionary, even though I was home in the middle of some of that. So around that time, my mission president asked me, he said, "So everybody else in this mission knows when they're going home because they know how to do math. You or we have no idea. So we need to come up with a date for you to come home just so you can work out whatever you need to work out, you know." And I said, "Okay, and I said, "What do you recommend?" And he said, right then he flipped through some pages, and April 6th was a transfer date. And he goes, "Oh, April 6th." And I said, "Oh, that's kind of it's an important date in Mormon history." He sounds good to me, and that was done. And I literally never even had the thought to add up the time. I just was like, okay, April 6th, cool. I like that's a fun date. And so I was there for 4 more months and went home. But yeah, it was about 22 and a half months altogether.
But it ended up being over the course of 2.5 years almost, the whole, if you take the
Christmas.
from end to end, yeah. Listen, Jake, I want to, since Montreal, obviously the most awesome mission on earth, right? I just want to, reminisce about it for a minute, because, I went there too, but I went there a good 10 years before you. Back when I went there, even though it was the most awesome mission on earth, it wasn't awesome because we were baptizing people. We absolutely were not. It was just this little mission. It seemed like there was too many missionaries for the amount of members, and so we just kind of, did other things besides baptize people or even teach. Teach was kind of a rare thing. But just the same, I super enjoyed the experience. I super enjoyed getting connected with the Quebec culture and stuff. So, how was it for you learning French? Was French really strange after your other experiences with French? Because the French Canadian French is super different, right?
Yes, it was. But it was, I mean, French was, I mean, I wouldn't say I struggled with the language, but it did not come as easy to me, because most of my, I went from French to English to French to English. I never was in a French area for more than 4 months
So while you're on
without,
the Montreal mission, you kept going into English interviews.
yes, a
That happened
lot
to
of,
me too, yeah.
I was in New York for 9 months of my time in and now
Were
you
my
also
parents
know.
there when you were there? My parents were in Montreal. They served in New York right around that time. Was there a couple missionary named Parkinson?
No, we had chapels. The only ones I knew.
Well, we have another common friend who served in Montreal, and that's Tom Christofferson. So, I suppose you knew he also went there?
I'm not. Yeah, I did. Okay, no, I did. In
But he was
fact,
there before me, right?
but the fact that you just said that, I was actually thinking that was you. But no,
I could see that confusion. No, he was there back basically when Wayne Owens was there. And Wayne Owens, as you recall, used to be a representative, a congressman from Utah who interrupted his congressional career to be a mission president. And the missionaries just loved him. I mean, he was apparently just really, really, you know, respected and admired by all of his missionaries. And we even have a story in No More Strangers about someone who served under him who told President Owens about being gay. And President Owens was just absolutely sympathetic and empathetic and really handled it in a way that was absolutely unshaming. And he advised the guy to finish his mission and, you know, just maybe he wouldn't be able to stay in the church after that, but at least he could go home, you know, in a way that seemed more respectful and respectable. And it just was a super experience for him that gave him sort of a really jump start in his life. He didn't stay in the church, but he really, really appreciated the conscientiousness and the empathy he got from his bishop president who was in Montreal. So that's another example, another great story from there.
Yeah, I only knew, back to what you were saying earlier about, well, do you know what years your parents were there?
No, I'd have trouble remembering. It was kind of like you. They went to France, but they had health problems, my mother, so they got reassigned and Montreal made sense. But then they didn't try too hard to keep them in French areas. They went to, well, they were in Valleyfield and then they went to New York. So, yeah. But I know about that. I served in Ottawa, and I loved it. It was a super fun break from the regular routine to go to Ottawa and have a missionary experience that was more similar to what most North Americans were having. But it did sort of, my French suffered because of it. You know, I didn't get quite a chance. And I was in back in the day when it was an 18 months mission. So it was even shorter to start with. So if you take away the months I spent in English neighborhoods, it was less than a year for me. So, but how was the church growing there at the time? Because it did seem like they had kind of a boom around there sometime.
I mean, not really. I mean, it not while I was there, and it was probably as bad as the French missions. The statistical numbers that you're not supposed to talk about as missionaries, it was something like, I think we had 0.7 baptisms per missionary for 2 years. So if you had the pleasure or the experience to baptize somebody, it was, you know, not that common actually.
Yeah.
A lot of, less active work, reactivation and that kind of thing. We baptized a mother and a son in New York, and that was it. But every area that I was in, we saw somebody come back to activity from having left the church. So there were some mild feelings of self-worth, you know what I mean, like success.
Yeah, because we weren't doing that yet when I was out. So
yeah,
that sounds like a nice addition to the missionary responsibilities, at least to feel like you're not just totally chasing your tail. Did overall, was that discouraging for you or just the low
success
rate?
It was, but at some point you kind of get used to it. And it just becomes what it is. But I don't know. My companions and I, we really, well, maybe this is just me. I really, going out knocking on doors all day long and just facing no, 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 no all day long is, yeah, nobody likes that. But I'm a pretty social person. So I found people that would talk to us and just talk to them, whether that was visiting with active church members, less active people that would have us, or people at Walmart that would just want to talk about Yankees baseball or something, you know?
Yeah.
It was, that was my mindset as a missionary, is just to give people positive experiences with members of the church.
Yeah. That's probably more effective anyway.
Yeah, because you're not going to baptize them, but they may, 8 years later, they may say, hey, I remember that guy. What a nice guy, you know?
Yeah.
And you've kind of laid a seed. And that was my mindset, not, you know, instead of judging success based on baptisms, which really is, you know, souls to Christ, if you will. Note my air quotes, but
yeah.
But you mean that's what it's about. But ultimately, you're just trying to make a difference at some level somewhere. So,
yeah.
But no, when I was in New York, though, I was in New York, like I said, for like 9 months. I had five companions there.
Wow.
I mean, they kept coming and going. It was weird. I thought the mission. I was like, Mr. President, I'm still down here. You know, I was like, man, I'm really good or I really need to figure something out, you know, to get out of here.
Yeah.
And it was probably the latter. But I saw so many elders come through, you know, so.
How about Montreal? Were you there for a while? Or
no, I was in Verdun for the last month of my mission.
Okay.
And I actually went, they sent me there to close an area. They closed Verdun when we left.
Oh, okay.
And so I actually went there with a guy that I had been in the MTC I went with a guy. I went there with a guy that was going home the same time I was. So we finished out the area together. Yeah. And we did. I mean, it was the biggest waste of time, if you will.
Wow.
We were both transferred there the same time. It was weird. Both transferred there the same time. We didn't know anybody. He's a guy that liked to sit around the house and not do much. And it was horrible. I mean, the last month was just absolutely horrible. And we went to church and we tried to, you know, I got real involved with the zone, other missionaries, and tried to just be part of things because dragging my companion out was next impossible.
So he was chunky.
To say the least, yeah.
So, you know, because that's funny. I had Verdun in my district for a while, and so I have pleasant memories of Verdun. So it's interesting how it can be shaded in different ways based on factors like that, you know?
Sure.
Because, yeah, we would do trades there, and I thought it was a great place because I liked these super blue-collar neighborhoods because it was the same thing. I mean, maybe we weren't going to baptize anybody, but if you had the super blue-collar neighborhood, at least on every street, there's a mentally ill person who's going to let you in, you know? So you at least talk to somebody, even. So it didn't seem like quite as, you know, just to only having, you know, door slamming or not so friendly encounters, you know? But
no, absolutely. And I mean, most of my mission I remember from New York. I mean, I had the most memorable experiences. I mean, we baptized, like I said, a mother and a son in a river, actually behind the state, I mean, the branch president's house.
Uh-huh.
She bore her testimony at her own baptism, and she likened it to, I mean, her very limited knowledge of the Book of Mormon, but she drew a parallel of the end of the Book of Mormon and, you know, the Lamanites and how, you know, the Hill Cumorah and being up there in that area where like the end of the Book of Mormon must have taken place. And she talked about being baptized in a river where maybe other Nephites were baptized in. It was really kind of cool. It was a cool moment, you know?
Yeah.
Just for her to kind of draw the parallels and to know, just to see how much she kind of already knew.
Yeah.
But, it was interesting, but we just found this. I mean, it was the river was, it was probably a quarter mile across. It was really wide, but it was probably 2 to 3 feet deep in most places and fairly active. I mean, you know, pretty brisk pace. And we found this little tiny little cove area that, really small, where we were able to, you know, we were about waist deep.
Yeah.
And we were able to baptize him, which was
to dunk her the first shot. You didn't have to do too many retries.
Nope. Yep. But both. yeah. I think my companion baptized her and I baptized her son, and it was cool.
Yeah.
I think he might have been 11 or 12, 11 years old.
Okay. So how old you were when you joined?
Yeah. Yeah. It was close.
Yeah. Okay.
The cool thing with that was my companion and I were together for 4 months there, which is a pretty long companionship in our mission.
Yeah.
And we found them, taught them, and baptized them all together. Just the two of us went through the whole process, which doesn't happen often either.
Yeah.
So that was a neat experience to have them have the same two people the whole time. And my companion and I definitely, we appreciated that experience together. And I can't find that guy on Facebook. And if if anybody ever listens to this, and it's Mark Phillips, boy, I've been looking for that guy forever.
Yeah, well, he's got to be out there, huh?
I know,
it's
I good know.
That you can't Google him, but it's too many people with that name, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny that we, you know, since Facebook came around, how we, you know, connect with all these people who are kind of lost to our lives, and so I've kind of done that. My generation, not everybody goes on Facebook, so there's a lot of people I simply don't find because they just simply don't go to Facebook. But
right.
It's kind of been fun reconnecting.
Yeah, it's easy. I see people that I haven't seen in 15 years, and it's not exciting because I'm like, I feel like I've been seeing you every day for, you know, I mean, you know what's happening in everybody's lives, even if you just check in occasionally.
Yeah.
And people look, nobody is, you're not surprised that people are either overweight or really thin or bald or not, because you've seen them already.
Yeah. Well, let's see, because you were in the early 90s, right? You were
correct.
Okay, so yeah, I think you were just 10 years after me.
Yeah, like 93 and 94 were my main 2 years.
Yeah, okay. Well, so let's go on with your trajectory then. You came home, somehow you got out to Provo, so.
Well, let me make one other comment about my mission, and while I was in New York, and this will relate in a little bit, but in New York, we had three areas there's three areas in New York, Potsdam, Messina, and Ogdensburg. And I was in Ogdensburg. And there was a lot of missionaries came through Potsdam. Potsdam there was a university there or a college there that was rated, I can't remember what it's called, but it won some award in like some national magazine of being like one of the most party schools in the country.
Okay.
So, you know, that's completely irrelevant. But there was a guy there, a missionary, who he just seemed to struggle and didn't really know why. He struggled with his weight a little bit. He went on it was kind of funny. He went on a 3 Slim Fast a day diet. That's all he ate, just 3 Slim Fast. I know. And he lost weight, but it was a struggle. And I remember like my heart aching for the guy a little bit, just feeling like he was trying to find a spot to fit in, you know? Yeah. And I just remember just enjoying his company because I felt like he enjoyed mine. I don't know how else to really put it. But I don't know. Really nice guy. I wouldn't say that we were really good friends, but he was somebody that I kind of genuinely cared about a little bit more than other missionaries, and I didn't really know why. I think mostly because he was just a little bit different. I could tell that he was struggling, and that didn't sit well with me. I'll jump to the future a little bit with this particular person. I don't know if you use Gmail, but on Gmail over on the left side, you have everybody that, like a lot of your friends, it'll say who's online and you can chat with them. And this particular elder, at some point we had exchanged information, you know, email, because of course emails and computers, the internet wasn't around when we were on our mission.
Right.
But, so at some point we'd hooked up with each other and got information, and his name was just, he was a guy that was always online. I always saw his name off to the left. And about every 9 months, 9 to 10 months, I would just ping him and say, "Hey man, how's it going?" You know?
Yeah.
And we would talk for 90 seconds and that was it. But once a year or so, just kind of check in because I looked at his name every day.
Yeah.
And we were friends on Facebook, and he also was out of the closet gay.
Okay.
Which I had learned just by, he didn't say it ever. We didn't talk about it, but looking at Facebook, it was very apparent and very obvious, and he wasn't hiding anything, right?
Yeah.
But we never talked about it. And that didn't make me uncomfortable or anything like that, you know. Maybe it was a reason why I didn't talk to him every month, and maybe I talked to him every 10 months. I don't know, you know, because I think I've told you before, I've never been like best friends with any gay guys, but I never was too uncomfortable or awkward, somewhere in the middle. But there was probably some level of just unfamiliarity that didn't quite sit right with me. That made gay people not quite as approachable. Something that obviously I need to say, I feel very, very differently about now. So when John came out to us, and I'm jumping to recent here, but when John came out to us, he was one of the first people that I reached out to. He might have been the third or fourth person that I told outside of our tight family or our immediate family. I was kind of asking, I said, "Hey, can I ask you some questions?" He goes, "Of course," and we started talking about it. And I was kind of doing what John did with Andy. I was just kind of building that relationship of trust and seeing what I could ask him. And I've never done this in my life, Daniel. And I actually did this with this friend of mine. I played the "I have a friend who has a kid who's gay." I actually did that, and I'm like making fun of myself in my own mind as I'm doing that, because I did it because not for me, because I just didn't want to out anybody that wasn't ready to be out yet. And 2 minutes into the conversation, I quickly realized, I was like, this isn't the place for that. I was realizing this gay community is primarily so respectful on that topic that I quickly felt really safe. About outing my son, if you will, to a stranger. But so we talked over the next month and a half often, like a lot. And somewhere in that, he gave me a little bit of his story. And my point is the following: is he told me, he said he actually was out of the closet at church before his mission. He knew he was gay, and people at church knew he was gay. He was quote unquote worthy. But at school, he was not out of the closet, which would seem that would be a difficult thing. And so he went on a mission and, was able to serve a mission. He went on a mission, and he told me, he said, for 2 years, he said, "Jake, it was like a miracle, literally a miracle." And he's completely like disaffected from the church now. It doesn't really go, but has positive feelings towards the church, not anti. But he said, "Jake, for 2 years, I literally had no attraction. I was never attracted to any of my companions. I didn't see people on the street and was like, wow, there's a cute guy." And he said, "It just gone." And then he said, "Well, except," he said, "well, there was one scenario where I was attracted to another guy, but it was only once, and it was only for a short period of time in one of my areas, and that was it." But he said it was a miracle, and he certainly attests that to like a blessing from God, to help him through that. And me, being the smartie that I am, Daniel, I said, "Well, who was the guy? Was it me?" Just literally just being, just a smart, hey, I don't know. He goes, "It was." And I was like, "Oh." And then I was like, "Okay, now this is this." I was like, "Now I feel awkward. Should this be awkward?" But then he said something, and I haven't talked about this yet, but I will. And it's about the immediate thoughts I had after John came out to us. I mean, I had thoughts about that I'm embarrassed about having, and I feel horrible that I had them, about ways that how selfish I was feeling, and just some of the things that went through my mind that I was like, oh my gosh, what kind of father am I to have these thoughts, right? And I felt really guilty about that for a couple of days, about my initial reaction. Not verbally how I reacted, because I was very conscientious of controlling that, but just in my mind,
Just some of the thoughts that went through your head
right, that were
that.
probably normal reactions in our culture, but they're ones I wish I could have reacted differently in my mind. And like I said, we'll get to that, but it was something that I had been struggling with a little bit because I was like, man, I was like, I am so prejudiced, you know, I'm discriminatory, and I was feeling guilty about some of these thoughts that I was having. And when this when he told me when this former missionary friend of mine told me that he'd been attracted to me in the mission field, he told me why. And the reason that he told me, it was exactly what I needed to hear more than anything. And he said, because you treated me like a human being. He said, nobody else in the mission, companions, like nobody else. I felt like everybody treated me differently. I didn't tell anybody that I was gay, but I felt like everybody knew it. I felt like you knew it, and everybody knew it, and you treated me like a person. He said, and it made it that was very attractive to me. And it was, and it threw me, it kind of, it caught him off guard. And you know, and I was like, initially I was like, well, you know, wow, thank you, I'm flattered, you know, but at the same time, it was what I needed to hear, because I was kind of self-loathing a little bit about how I was reacting to having a gay son. And I needed to hear that I wasn't as prejudiced or discriminatory as I thought I was, you know, because I'd been racking my brain. I was like, man, I've been a horrible person towards this whole group of people all these years, you know. But hearing him say that was, it felt good, you know. And I, like I said, I needed to hear it.
Yeah, well, but really, I mean, you can't help it if you had prejudices. I had them too. I mean, we all got them from we all get these messages, right? So it's impossible that you wouldn't have prejudices. It's impossible that I wouldn't have prejudice against myself or that your friend. But the difference is, it's sort of the same idea as what happened to you when this other companion in Ivory Coast held your hand. You prioritize the human interaction. So what? So for whatever reason you might be inclined to have a prejudice towards this guy at the time, you put that secondary to what really was important to you, which was, you know, caring about this person. And this is what you were on a mission doing. And so it sounds like you really took that to heart, not just with your investigators and with your contacts on the street, but also with the other missionaries, that you were gonna be empathetic towards them. So that is great. And that definitely overcomes prejudice, because even if you have the prejudice, if you're setting it aside, that's really meaningful. Because we all have prejudice. We all have racism. We all have sexism. We all have homophobia. We got to admit it.
Well, thank you for saying so, Daniel. I mean, I'm definitely a lot harder on myself than you are on me, but I
Well, I mean, I
appreciate you saying
realized
that,
this a
but.
ways back, that if I don't admit that I'm racist, you know, like, it's terrible that I'm racist, but what's worse is if I'm racist and don't admit it. Now, I shouldn't say I'm racist with pride. I just need to say racist with the same way you're saying you have this homophobic prejudice, is that these things were ingrained in me all my life, and it's impossible that they're not impacting my thought process. And it's my job to understand them, to make sure I'm compensating for them, to make sure that these thoughts aren't weighing how I'm interacting with people and aren't causing me to treat people as less than. But the only way I'm not going to treat them by less than is to realize that these things are built into my mindset from a childhood that I can't undo. And so people, you know, are ashamed to say they're racist, and they should be, and I am. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge our internal racism. We have to acknowledge our internal sexism, and we have to acknowledge our internal homophobia. We have to acknowledge our internal transphobia. If we don't, we're not going to compensate for them. We're not going to rectify them.
That's
So
interesting.
you know, yeah, you should feel bad that they're there, but you can't undo your childhood. You can't undo all these influences that created that. So, but you can correct for it, and you can let respect of human and the moral ideal of not being racist, the moral ideal that everyone's equal, be more powerful in this case than these internalized negativities that we carry, and use that as a tool to analyze it and to set it aside, or at least not let it impact us, or try to learn how to remove them, you know, uproot them if you can. You can't always, but you can certainly take them into account. So
no, that's well said.
I think it's a, I think it's an important idea. So I'm glad we talked about it. So, and this is so true of gay people. Gay people have so much internalized homophobia. If we don't realize that, you know, if we don't realize that we got these same messages and that they impact our self-esteem, they impact how we interact with people, they impact our shame, it's part of the same thing. And so that's also super important to be aware of, right?
Right. Oh, yes.
So, okay. Well, so that's super nice that you connected with the guy and that he must have also felt really good that you reached out to him in that situation and that he was able to really relate to you in a, once again, in a real way. So
yeah. And I think he should be, we have the affirmation conference coming up in September and I think he's going to be coming.
Excellent.
And so, yeah, I'll be excited. I'll be excited to see him. So
yeah.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see the podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation today at gaymormonstories.org. Music for this podcast was graciously donated by Nabby Parkinson Folk and Ricky Parkinson.
That thou hast shown pause to help and lift another, finding strength beyond my own. Savior, may I learn to love thee. Sorrow that the eye